As I was contemplating what to be talking about this time of year, beginning of the year, also I'm very aware of all the upheaval that's been going on, several quadrants of our lives. So I decided I want to do a series of talks on what are called the four Brahma Viharas. Typically, the word Brahma is translated as the higher power of the Indian world. In fact, at the time of the Buddha, the faith tradition was called Brahmanism. Vihara basically is a dwelling place or an abode. And interesting, there's a state, province of India that's called Bihar. And that's actually the contemporary pronunciation of Vihara, which goes back to the pre-Buddhist era. The four Brahma Viharas are basically a way to focus in on an important part of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention. Right intention is one half of the wisdom aggregate of the Eightfold Path. The other half is right understanding or right view. Right view basically means direct knowledge of the three characteristics of impermanence and non-self and the consequences of craving and clinging, which is dukkha. Also, the reality of karma, that our behaviors, our actions have consequences. And right intention is the four Brahma Viharas. Metta, which is loving kindness. Karuna, which is compassion. Mudita, which is sympathetic joy. And upekkha, which is equanimity. Now, the Brahma Viharas were not something that were originated by the Buddha. This is something apparently that had been part of the Vedic tradition for quite a while before the time of the Buddha. But he, you know, as he often did, he incorporated what was already culturally available, repurposed it, and so that's why we have the notion of right intention in the Brahma Viharas. And these are legitimate contemplations of the Buddhist world. And the goal of the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas is to realize the reality of non-self, of interdependence, interbeing. Now, what I want to talk about, as I am prone to do, is this doctrine from a contemporary psychological and neurological perspective. There's been a lot of research in my lifetime. In fact, the research began when the Americans were in Japan after and Korea after World War II. Started studying Zen Buddhism. One of the first books that I that involved psychological research was about Zen Buddhism. very rudimentary kind of psychological studies. This is before all the neuroscience really took off. One of the things that we're trying to cultivate, primary thing we're trying to cultivate, is mindfulness of feelings. Second foundation, the four foundations of mindfulness. And mindfulness of feelings basically is awareness of affect. And affect is a felt sense of either attraction or repulsion regarding subjective experience. And this attraction and repulsion, we tend to objectify. What I mean by that is, we say that, you said something that hurt me, or you said something that delighted me. But that's not really what we're investigating with our practice. What we're investigating is the subjective aspect of the experiences that we have. So when somebody says something, it really is just vibration in the air. And it stimulates the auditory nerve, and the mind makes something out of it, makes an identity out of it. And that identity is either brings delight or fear or resentment. So an important part of what we're doing with our meditation practice is understanding affect, which we could call emotion, but we're more focused not so much on emotion as such, but the kind of drive that comes with the experience of an emotion. In terms of the four Brahma Viharas, we're also focusing in on empathy. Empathy is a very crucial aspect of ourselves as humans. We are social creatures. We operate the same kind of interactions as animals such as canines or apes or whales or dolphins. There are others, I imagine, that we're not really that attuned to. But we are social animals. And any social animal has to have some wiring, if you will, for empathy. Some sense of how to read the environment, particularly the social environment. Now, our ability to empathize is, way beyond what other social animals can experience. Although, my dog is really, really tuned in to what I'm doing and what my wife is doing. So I've learned a lot about empathy from our pets. And I'm sure that other people have pets and the same experience. But our empathic attunement is significantly enhanced through language, through our ability to put words to the experience of empathy. Now, empathy involves emotion, involves affect, but it is a special kind of reference. In the structure of the brain, we have discovered several sites that are associated with empathy. They're loosely called mirror neurons, but there's some question about whether that terminology is really that beneficial. One part of the brain is involved with mimicry. A lot of what we learn from observing others. Now, animals like apes and so forth and so on also learn through mimicry. And that's part of their empathic equipment, if you will. There's another kind of empathy that has to do with emotions more specifically. I've done neurological research hooking up telemetry, you know, little electrodes and so forth to infants and toddlers and adults as well. You know, the whole range of humanity in terms of ages. And presented the subjects with images or sounds that were indicative of pain. For example, if you watched a videotape of someone whose finger had been cut, the part of your brain that would be activated if your finger was cut lights up, gets stimulated. But we don't literally feel that physical discomfort, but quite often people feel anxious, feel upset when that sort of stimulus is presented. So that's another way to think about mirror neurons. We also know that when people are in social situations that don't necessarily involve physical injury, that brainwave patterns and areas of the brain that are activated have some similarity among humans. In other words, we feel things similarly. Now, this is very useful for pack animals. I mean, back in the day, when proto-humans were wandering the planet, proto-humans did not have big, long fangs or claws, not particularly strong. So had to really rely on teamwork for survival. And empathy is a very important component of teamwork. This is what allowed people to read each other, to establish hierarchies, which is something that has to happen in a pack, cooperate in certain tasks, you know, seeking food or building shelters, and to protect each other when there was injury or illness or some kind of, you know, aggressive attack. So this is really important. And when proto-humans developed language, this took this experience of empathy and its value to a much higher level than with other pack animals, because we could convey words through words what we were feeling. Now, humans can read each other, body language, facial expressions, tone of voice, gestures in the body, so forth and so on. And I can tell you for sure my dog can do that with me. But when we put words to it, it makes a huge difference. You know, I spent a whole career as a psychotherapist, and one of the things that we know in the field is a function is called mentalizing. And mentalizing basically means putting words to actions. And I talked about mimicry earlier. If you see a child sees an adult do something, particularly if the child is, you know, just a toddler and just learning language, they don't know why the person's doing what they're doing or what the motivation is. So a good parent will put words to their feelings. You know, they'll say, "I did this because I was happy. or I did this because I was frightened, or whatever. That really amplifies the process of empathy, makes it much more useful, and that's how culture is created. An important part of culture is that it's able to be transmitted from one generation to the next. And that includes the whole notion of affect and feelings. So we have this capacity. It was developed. And now this empathy and the ability to verbalize it is genetic. You know, the someone who does not have empathy wired into their brain or can't speak is really an outlier. You know, very, very, very small percentage of humanity is that way. And they just basically can't function. Now, this went on for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, we suppose. And then the development of language and the refinement of empathic attunement and culturization developed enough stability regarding food and shelter, protection from the elements and protection from hostility, so that civilizations could start to develop. And this was something that was going on prior to the time of the Buddha, maybe 1,000 years or so, but was reaching a crucial point during maybe 1,000 years around the time of the Buddha. Spirituality started to develop. And as far as I'm concerned, spirituality is a sophistication of empathy. One of the basic messages of all the faith traditions involves kindness, compassion, generosity, which is a major form of sympathetic joy, and the ability to work with diversion in terms of changes in societal functions, either, you know, as they're immediately happening or intergenerationally. This is core to, you know, all these basic faith traditions in the world today. Now, what I appreciate about Buddhism is that the four Brahma-Vihara contemplations provide a discipline, a training, a craft for cultivating these understandings, these empathic attunements. And that's what I want to endeavor, my endeavor here is in terms of the next several weeks, is to talk about loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Now, I've also, you know, talked about the neuroscience of it. One of the things that's important to understand about empathy is that empathy doesn't necessarily have any kind of built-in regulatory function. What I mean by that is that we are not equipped to really understand and develop kindness. We have to train for that. Now, when I'm talking about each of these, for example, loving kindness, what Buddhism calls the near enemy and the far enemy. The far enemy of loving kindness is aversion and ill will, hatred, aggression. The near enemy is its sentimentality, or idealization. An example of it would be, you know, I'm going to love you until you do something that doesn't meet my standards for what loving me means. And then love turns to hate. So the kind of engagement that goes on socially among people, among ethnic groupings, is significantly impacted by this sort of lack of discipline, lack of training. You'll meet someone from a different ethnic background, and they might be interesting and maybe exotic for a while, but then they do something because of their cultural history that does not fit in with your rendering of what is polite or appropriate, and that causes problems. One of the conflicts that occurred between Europeans and the original inhabitants of the Western Hemisphere involves what it means to have things. Many of the indigenous cultures shared things. That was part of their ethical mores. When the Europeans came here, the cultural mores did not necessarily involve that. So when a European, let's say a Spaniard, would interact with someone in Central America, there was not the same kind of understanding of what it meant to trade. You know, the trading that would go on amongst the indigenous people had certain rules and involved certain understandings of what it meant to be kind or compassionate or generous. And that would be in conflict with the European model. And so there'd be all this confusion and fighting because of it. And gold was very important in terms of Mesoamerican culture, particularly in Mexico. But it had a very different sort of importance in terms of the Europeans and all the stuff that came about as a result of that sort of misunderstanding. That kind of misunderstanding can be resolved when the empathetic attunement between the parties is more highly developed. And I'm sure that happened amongst these different groups, Europeans and Mesoamericans. But often it didn't. So these sorts of conflicts are important to address. Now, I'm beginning of the talk tonight, I mentioned, you know, these are stressful times. There's a lot of fear going on in the culture around the world. But in culture of the U.S., you know, there's a lot of fear about certain ethnic groups being disenfranchised one way or the other, or about what it means to be socially or ecologically responsible. A lot of misunderstanding. And so there's a lot of hostility. Fear often manifests as aggression, verbal or otherwise. So this is also endemic in our culture these days. And so I think that it's very important for us to cultivate the Brahma Viharas as individuals. It's a responsible thing to do, because we're going to encounter, and we do encounter on a regular basis, people who have very different opinions. Today, my dog and I are out walking in the neighborhood, which we do every day. And there's a particular person who lives in the neighborhood who I've nodded to, said hi to. But today, my dog is very friendly. So she pulls me up to this fellow, and I notice that he's wearing a hat that says Second Amendment. And he's wearing camouflage pants, right? Well, those are markers, right? This is the whole empathy thing is running. I'm just a guy wearing a gray baseball hat. I wasn't wearing one that says "Make America Green Again," you know, which might have stirred something up for this fellow. But what I wanted to bring to the encounter was the joy of being with this dog who's so friendly. That's what was the guiding principle of it. I could have gotten caught up in fear or resentment or some kind of difficulty, but I was aware that that potential was there, but it did not, was not a motivation for me. And I hope it won't be a motivation in my future exchanges with this person. So, another aspect of our contemporary life that this addresses is greed. You know, I've talked about this many times. We live in a consumer culture. An important part of consumer culture is indoctrination, advertising. And it is embedded in our culture. Billboards, commercials, movies, television, with product placement and with certain cultural values that are just so woven into the fabric that you really don't think about what you're being conditioned toward. You're supposed to be a certain kind of way. You're supposed to wear a certain kind of clothing, look a certain way in terms of your skin color, gender, so forth and so on. All of these factors are manipulated in the consumer culture. And that creates a lot of conflict. Greed leads to hatred when that greed is frustrated. In fact, that's the three poisons in Buddhism: greed, hatred, and ignorance. And what we're trying to do here is to counter that. And that's why the four Brahma Viharas are subdivided. You know, the leading edge, if you will, the umbrella under which all of it's contained is kindness, benevolent, intention, goodwill. Within that, you find compassion. And it's a function of kindness that is alert to empathetic regarding suffering, rather regarding distress and confusion in oneself and in other beings. Or by extension, you could even anthropomorphize it onto the planet. The planet is suffering. Pollution, climate disruption, you know, all the fires that have happened and the storms and all the stuff that's come with that is part of it. So it's important for us to understand how we have been conditioned. This is the part of right understanding. How we are being conditioned to see things a certain way, to see ourselves a certain way, and to so easily fall into gratification or defense regarding our identities. And to be compassionate about that. And of course, the third one, the third of the four Brahma Viharas is sympathetic joy. And for me, sympathetic joy is very closely aligned with generosity and with a clear understanding of how important it is to share. Not just materially, but share through listening to one another, being supportive of one another. And I'll be talking about these topics more in depth in future meetings. And the fourth of the Brahma Viharas is equanimity. Now, actually, next week, I'm not going to talk about loving kindness. Next week, my intention is to talk about equanimity. Because equanimity is really, it really involves right understanding. It involves vipassana. It involves the ability to be mindful and investigate and practice right effort regarding the experience of loving kindness. So it doesn't fall into aversion and ill will, the far enemy, or idealization, the near enemy. So I want to talk about that first. And then when I talk about loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy, there'll all already be something sort of in the books about these, the ability to regulate these affective experiences. Next thing I want to talk about in terms of the physiology of this is something that's called the vagus nerve. The word vagus comes from Latin, and it's obviously the word vague comes from the Latin, but vagus basically means wandering. And the vagus nerve is by far the largest nerve in the body. And there are actually two trunks, if you will, the efferent and the afferent. One of them comes from the brain, goes down to the throat, goes to the face, but the throat, connections to the throat, connections to the lungs, the heart, and down to the organs, particularly the intestines. Another branch of it originates in those organs, goes back up, just feedback to the brain. One of the things that's been discovered is how important the vagal process is in terms of our mental well-being and our social security, our feeling of being secure in relationships. So I doing my research, came across an article that was in the Psychology Today website for Psychology Today in May of 2017. The title of the article is Kindness Towards Oneself and Others, by a fellow named Christopher Berglund. So here's an excerpt from that article. In 2010, Barbara Fredrickson of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and Bethany Koch of the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences published their landmark study, Upward Spirals of the Heart, Autonomic Flexibility as Indicated as Indexed by Vagal Tone Reciprocally and Prospectively Predicts Positive Emotions and Social Connectedness, in the journal Biological Psychiatry. Fredrickson and Koch hypothesized that having a higher vagal tone might be part of an upward spiral that was part of a multi-directional feedback loop. It could be accessed from various points of entry. Interestingly, they found people with higher vagal tone had better overall heart health, lower levels of inflammation, stronger social bonds, and tend to exhibit better emotion regulation. For example, genuine, wholehearted micro moments of social connectedness between two individuals appeared to instantaneously trigger a parasympathetic tend and befriend response that would improve vagal tone for both parties involved. The positive visceral and psychological feedback of these warm-hearted exchanges led people to expand social networks in a way that spread positive emotions and pro-social behaviors. From an evolutionary standpoint, one could speculate that this biological response became hardwired as part of a survival mechanism that nurtured cooperative human bonds and alliances that benefited both the individual and the collective. The vagus nerve helps to regulate heart rate and is also a key player in our social engagement systems. Long before modern-day researchers were studying the science of human emotion and loving kindness as being linked to the vagus nerve, scientists were interested in how vagal tone affected the psychology of the heart. When you inhale, heart rate speeds up a bit. When you exhale, the release of acetylcholine, which was originally referred to as Vagusstoff, German for vagus substance, slows your heart rate down and prepares your body to rest and digest. A healthy heart is also marked by a high rate of variability, HRV, as you breathe in and out. In 2013, Fredrickson and colleagues conducted another groundbreaking study that looked at the role that practicing loving-kindness meditation, LKM, in making the upward spiral dynamic between vagal tone, positive emotion, close-knit human bonds, and physical health more robust. The key ingredient to turbocharging this upward spiral of improved vagal tone appeared to be sending loving kindness toward oneself and towards others, including loved ones, but also rivals, enemies, a nemesis, or anyone you hold a grudge against. The foundation of LKM echoes the wisdom of Henry Wadsworth Longfellow, who famously said, "If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each man's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility." So vagal tone basically means that the transmission of information from the brain down into the body, from the body back up to the brain, is not jarring. It's not harsh or conflicted. You know, talk about a sinking feeling in your stomach. That's fear, right? So there's a signal going from the vagal process back up to the brain, and it creates a subjective experience of a sinking feeling. There are lots of other examples that are found in the literature of that kind of exchange. Alternatively, when someone has really mastered the practice of the four Brahma-Viharas, encountering that same kind of situation that would elicit the sinking feeling in one person, there would be equanimity instead in a person who was highly skilled. Here's an example from that early Zen study that I alluded to. They hooked up devices that could measure heart rate and what's called electrodermal response. When a person is anxious, the body tends to sweat very slightly. Moisture comes out of the skin. The more anxious the person is, the more liquid there is. If you put electrodes on two fingers, when a person is really anxious, more electricity is transmitted. When they're calm, less anxiety is transmitted. So that becomes a way to register the level of anxiety. This is an important part of what lie detectors involve. They also measure heart rate, breathing patterns, and so forth and so on. Not an entirely reliable system for detecting whether a person's lying or not, but certainly tells whether that person's anxious. So they hooked up this stuff. They had what they call a naive subject, just a regular person, and they had the test subject, which would be a Zen monk. The test that they gave was they heated a glass rod to a certain temperature that would elicit a pain response. Not enough to burn somebody, but enough to create a reaction in the nervous system. A signal would go from the arm up to the brain and would stimulate the vagus nerve. They would present this heated rod to the subjects, the naive subject and the Zen monk, at unscheduled intervals. Could not predict when it would happen. So when they touch the naive subject, the baseline would be a certain level, then they would be burned, you know, they'd feel the heat, so their anxiety would go up, then it would start to go down, then the next time a touch happened, it would go up, but it wouldn't go back down the baseline. So there would be a building up, a raising up, so the general level of anxiety was becoming more and more amplified with repeated exposure. Right? This is the vagus nerve in operation. The Zen monk, they would register the pain, but then it would go back to baseline. Register the pain, go back to baseline. Register the pain, go back to baseline. There was no increase in anxiety. This was an early recognition that something important was going on in terms of affect regulation among people who were practicing meditators. So the vagal tone in the Zen monk would be very balanced. The vagal tone in the naive subject would not be. Does that clarify it? Does that make more sense? Is that what we're talking about here? So that's one aspect. The next thing I want to talk about in terms of the four Brahma Viharas involves mantras. Now, the most frequent application of it, the primary application of mantra is with loving kindness meditation. And when I do the loving kindness week, there will be a guided loving kindness meditation that comes before the meeting. But the loving kindness mantra involves repeating certain terms. I'll just say the mantra now for example. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, may I be content. May I love myself sincerely and with gently patient kindness, just as I am now, no matter what happens. When I teach people loving kindness meditation, and I've taught courses on it, retreats, I ask, when you hear the word safe, what kind of associations come to mind? People will say secure, relaxed, peaceful, so forth and so on. Same with happy. Each one of those words has an emotional association, an affective association. We all want to be safe. So safety involves what's called affect approach. You want to be safe. You want to maintain safety. If I use the word, may I be unsafe, or may I be frightened, there would be associations, emotional associations. That would be manifested like the naive subject in that Japanese research, where the person's baseline anxiety would creep up. So in the context of using the mantra, what I encourage people to do is to focus on their heart, the middle of the chest, an important junction for the action of the vagal process, and to sincerely and mindfully repeat the mantra. What I'm doing there is trying to create a bridge, an association between a particular word and whatever kind of affect would be associated with it. So you're really building bridges, neurological bridges, using words. And, you know, a lot of words, particularly nouns, but verbs as well, are associated with emotions, like or don't like emotions. So that's the intention behind using mantra, particularly with loving kindness. It also applies to compassion, but less so, and even less with sympathetic joy. And equanimity is really more about being mindful and staying balanced in cultivating the other three of the viharas. So in summing up, I guess I would say, it's important to realize that meditation is a skill. It's a craft. It's like learning to play a musical instrument, or to type on a computer keyboard, or to carve a piece of wood so it looks beautiful, or tap dance. It requires a lot of practice and a lot of failure. So what happens when you create a goal, an aspiration, repeating the mantra with sincerity, and focusing on the middle of the chest? What that's doing is building neurological networks. The more you repeat them, the stronger they are, the more accessible they are. Of course, this is in competition with the other neural pathways that have been established for over the course of a lifetime that are organized around not feeling safe, being unhappy, being unhealthy and discontented, and not loving yourself, and not being kind and patient, and having all kinds of qualifications. So just as I am now, no matter what happens, becomes very, very qualified. You know, that's my personal mantra. And the reason why I added that last phrase on there, because I kept being aversive toward my practice when my mind would slip away from the mantra. So just as I am now, even forgetful, back to, may I be safe, may I be happy. So it's important to recognize the value of patient, sincere, clear repetition in terms of cultivation of the Brahma Viharas. Same thing is true with mindfulness of breathing. And mindfulness of breathing also plays a significant role, as far as I'm concerned, in the cultivation of the Brahma Viharas. One of the things that I've developed over the last umpty-ump years is trying to coordinate in-breath and the out-breath with various meditative projects. So I try to coordinate repeating the mantra with my breathing. Not that I'm going to breathe in on one part of the phrase and breathe out on the other part of the phrase. That sometimes happens. But more along the lines of, I'm going to watch how the breath happens, as so the breath can be as normal and natural and as routine as possible, and also watch the mantra in the middle of the chest. So I've given myself this task. What that means is, in the same way that I said that the words are associated with particular affects, repeating the mantra and focusing on the chest becomes associated neurologically, behaviorally, becomes habituated, is the term, becomes habituated with mindfulness of breathing. And mindfulness of breathing becomes habituated with loving kindness. So these are all, I think, important tricks of the trade, if you will, skill sets that we can cultivate with this sort of practice. Okay, so that's my comments for the evening about the four Brahma Viharas. Now we have the opportunity for questions or comments about what you've heard me say tonight. Speak more loudly, please.
Yes. I was especially interested in your focus on the current discovery of the gut and the health and connection of the gut in our I guess, in our being, everything.
Yep.
And I think that people who are following this are gaining insight to good health in general, because when we see our bodies as integrated and functioning in an integrated way and a related way, we're better able to support a lot of aspects of our health.
Yeah, that was discussed in that article.
Yeah.
That, you know, vagal tone is associated with heart health and immune response and stress resiliency. So, yeah, absolutely.
I actually had a doctor who is a DO, and the DOs tend to work with the entire body.
Yep.
Point out, I had about this past spring, I had some mysterious disturbance in my being, and I spoke to you about it, and you suggested a couple of different things, but when I talked to my DO, and he works with hands, with his manipulations, and he can read things going on in the body through his hands on different things, and he often will, you know, put his hands here.
Here, indicating the back of your head and your neck.
The base of the skull,
mm-hmm.
the back of the head.
Which is where the vagus nerve enters into the brain.
Yes. And interestingly, I had other doctors that, Western medicine doesn't make that connection, because they look at us as different parts rather than an integrated
mm-hmm.
being. And he suggested, he actually worked with that, and it made a difference, just in calming the mental stuff that was going on. If we think about what was going on in March of 2021, with a lot of confusion and fear and lockdowns and all of the things that were happening, that was the effect, I think, that tended to build.
Right. And that's an example of a personified empathy. That was an empathetic attunement between him and you. Another article I was reading, this is a book by Sharon Salzberg on loving kindness, said that it's a two-way street. In other words, if two people come together and one of them is really frightened, it tends to affect, you know, stimulate fear in the other. Alternatively, if someone comes into a situation, relationship, and they're very calm, very peaceful, very kind and compassionate, it has an effect on someone else who would otherwise be upset and anxious. And as a psychotherapist, I consciously brought calmness and kindness and compassion into the exchange, knowing that just that mood would have an impact on the therapy session. Not just what was said or what was suggested about, you know, behaviors, but just being a kind and compassionate presence makes a difference. Mm-hmm. It may be an important part of what the placebo effect is about. Other questions or comments? All right, let's have our closing meditation. As I said earlier, next week we're going to start to talk about the different subdivisions of the four Brahma Viharas, but I'm going to talk about equanimity first, because that's the balancing factor. And that will involve mindfulness, but also be relative to the other three of the Brahma Viharas. So let's sit for a moment. Thank you. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well, and I hope that we all have some safety and actually some joy between now and the next time we have a chance to meet.